thanks for inviting me. Thanks you all, of course, for coming. Now, if you read the brochure you've been given, you might have seen that my talk will be focused on the extended mind thesis. Now, Mike told me a month ago that some of you might not be familiar with this thesis, so I just put at the beginning some slides, few slides, four or five slides, which should provide you some background information. Apologies for those who know the matter, and here there are indeed some people who know this better than me. This will sound a bit trivial, at least at the beginning, but it's needed for those who are not into this thing. So, we can start here a short time, so better start now. This standard mind thesis here is just a short definition, I put it there for you. Well, it's a view about cognition, or better, the physical mechanism of mind and cognition that envisions the emergence of extended cognitive system through the coupled combination of bodily manipulation, externally oriented resources, and media processing. Now, the idea basically is that cognition is not solely intracranial, nor merely embedded, but may sometimes occasionally spread across the boundaries of mind, body, and world. The whole thing is nicely summarized by a slogan that Andy coined back in the 90s, cognition ain't all in the head. Now, in the literature directed to the extended mind thesis, we can find two ways of understanding EMT. At least two ways, because you know, I just recently came across a paper in which the guy was arguing for a third way, exploring complementarity consideration, but this is an extra complication, we don't need to get into this. So the first way is so-called parity-based, consistently relies on functionalism, and, well, stresses the functional isomorphism, the functional similarity between biological, internal biological processes and allegedly extended one. So this has been famously promoted by Andy, but Mike and Andy, well, they are champions of this view, let's say. And alternative approaches, well, we'll get into this, so-called complementarity, and this is an alternative view that stresses the complementary contribution of inner and outer. Now, I just labeled this complementarity following Sutton, but if you follow Benari, you might want to call it integrationism, or according to Roland, amalgamationism, environmentalism, or more recently, amalgamationism. It is worth noting here that Andy has also consistently argued for this view, especially in his seminal papers, works. Now, if you ask Andy, he will tell you that, that there is no such distinction at all, because the complementarity based version was originally included in his book. Well, this is right, I mean, he is right, but it is also true that most of the debate focused about the standard mind thesis has been focused on this parity-based and parity-based argument, and complementarity has long been forgotten. So in recent years, this has developed as a sort of alternative, and it is indeed seen as an alternative by Sutton and Menari. So in this talk, I just want to focus on complementarity, because basically I think that complementarity consideration can provide much needed and either to underexploited leverage in exploiting defending EMT. So complementarity defenses of EMT stress the different contribution made by internal and externally located resources, and argue that it is precisely these differences that allow for the environment to play a transformative role in cognition. Here the idea is that different components of a softly assembled system can play quite different roles and have different properties, while nevertheless combining to make complementary contributions that enable flexible thinking and acting. Now, in my talk, I want to defend this view, this complementarity view, and I will therefore develop an argument for it based on the enmeshing of organism and their cognitive developmental issues. Now, the plan is to present a series of cases involving neural and cognitive development in which this enmeshing is realized by cortical plasticity. Then I will move on to niche construction and we'll try to show how we can get something like complementarity out of developmental niches. So the idea is to connect point one and two through the notion of ecological inheritance. The notion of ecological inheritance is classically understood within an evolutionary framework. I will propose to understand and to re-situate it into a developmental context. So the goal of this talk would be to make a developmental argument for complementarity from a phylogenetic standpoint. Here, so let me quickly point out some of the enemies. There are a lot. Enemies are all those views that describe functional organization as pre-specified and our nature as well, fix and constrain to develop in specific ways. So here we have all the imperfectness account of cognition, nihilism, jinx, centrism. And on this view, there is the integrated model proposed back in the 90s, early 90s, by Cosmis and Tooby. I'm not sure if you can pronounce Cosmis, but I think it's Cosmis. Okay. So according to this model, culture is based on a universal human nature and is constrained by it. And our brains are basically seen as a collection of highly modular domain-specific processors. So we have this view, this specified understanding of our human nature. In what follows, I will quickly present a series of examples which are supposed to undermine this case studies, the studies that are supposed to undermine this view. So first, I want to show you that functional specialization is experience dependent. Now, this much is established nicely by a famous study by Pascolion and Hamilton 2001, the metamodal brain. In this study, the experimenters took a group of people, normal-sided people, and blindfolded them for 5 days, from Monday morning until Friday evening. These people were confined into an hospital during this period, and they had to find their way through the hospital while blindfolded, which means they had to rely on touch and hearing. And during the day, they were also asked to learn how to read right. Now, at the end of this training period, on Friday evening, their brain were scanned using fMRI, and fMRI revealed the activation of the visual, in the case of Islam, the visual cortex, and showed that it takes a port for instance, when people were asked to discriminate between sameness or differences in bright symbols, and also when they were asked to distinguish pitch and tones. So after this study nicely established that after an extended period, say, of sensory deprivation, the visual cortex can take on new function, in the case of instant, auditory and tactile. The study is also important because it shows us that plasticity is not confined to childhood, but extends and persists into adulthood. Another important study is here, perhaps even more powerful, because it is to do with higher skills such as language. It's not one, it's a series of studies from Meltzoff and Kuhl. This study shows the power of social cultural activities in shaping and molding our cognitive functions. Now, it is widely known that kids in early stages of development have the capacity to distinguish all sounds across the languages of the world. This capacity, however, narrows with development, with age. It narrows because of the particular social cultural environment in which they are exposed and because of the particular language, the native language, which they are forced to learn. So these external conditions, this environmental stimulation triggers the activation of certain brain functions, which in turn determine a restriction of this capacity they originally possessed. So once again, I think this study nicely shows that the onboard neural machinery can come to be dovetailed to fit with the particular social cultural environment in which our brains grows. Another case study comes from sensory substitution. I'm not going into detail because we don't have time, but sensory substitution, well, if you are using a sensory substitution device, unless you're doing it on purpose for research, it means you are unfortunately impaired. If you are impaired, it means that you lost the sensory modality. What happens when you lose a sensory modality? Well, loss of sensory modality induces an invasion of the deprived cortical areas by inputs originating from other modalities. This phenomenon is called cross-modal plasticity. We just saw this in action in the previous studies from Pascual Lyon. Now, sensory substitution devices exploit this, the remarkable plasticity in neural opportunism, and they called this, and it's put up to, with training, obviously, with training, to supply an old perceptual modality to compensate for the loss of sensory or impaired sensory channel. Now, you can say that these sensory substitution devices are mind-enhancing tools. There's lots of evidence, if you want to go into this in the discussion, that shows us that this coupling with external devices give rise to augmented processes of deep biotechnological symbiosis. Now, I think this triptych of example I just presented nicely shows us that the enmeshing, the partnership, the whole thing of neurosymphony with the external environment shapes our cognitive functions. And it also establishes that, you know, now our brains gradually learn to treat external structures as reliable resources. And these resources, different, non-biological, becomes complementary parts to Stevens of our cognition, part of our cognition. Now, the notion of or reliance on external scaffolding, I think, nicely drives us to the second part of my talk, in which I want to implement the confirmation, the consideration I just made about the relevance within the framework provided by niche construction. So the idea by niche construction is that, it's very roughly, organisms can scaffold their environments in ways that may sometimes change their fitness landscape. Now, a crucial notion in the niche construction paradigm is the notion of ecological inheritance, a crucial tenet, which can be defined as the capacity of animals to self-engineer their selective environment and alter the environments of their descendants. This is nicely shown by, for instance, the case of earthworms, which alter and modify the chemistry and the structure of their soil through their burrowing behavior, digging behavior. And now, the notion of niche construction has acquired a prominent status in biology and in the colony sciences. Now, in especially the notion of ecological inheritance has become crucial in the debate directed to the extended mind thesis. Or, you know, you can call this the community downstream epistemic engineer, if you like this fancy expression coined by philosophers. Now, this notion has been used both to argue for and against the extended mind. Don't have time to get into detail, but certainly has argued, for instance, against the extended mind on the basis of the grounds of this notion. He has argued for a scaffolded view, which is, on his account, is supposed to be more powerful than the extended mind. Now, I think that he is right, but the problem with his account is he misreads EMP, because it bases his criticism on a certain understanding of EMT, which is parity-based. If we understand EMT within the complementary framework, maybe his criticism can be his view it becomes fully compatible with the extended mind thesis. Now, Wheeler and Clark have also, in their Travel Ethics paper, used this notion of ecological inheritance to argue for the extended mind against, and they have attacked strong destructionism, evolutionary psychology, massive modularity, and all those views that describe our brain as sort of Swiss Army knife. They have basically embraced a neuroconstructivist perspective and have argued for what they've called the emergent modularity, the same model that is capable for accounting for brain neurospecialization without the involvement of excessive predetermination or design. They emphasize the role of downstream and the importance of niche construction for human evolution and development. They have noticed an analogy between cultural transmission of knowledge and physical niche construction, and I say that, well, basically, the latter generates selection impacting feedback cycles in evolutionary time, whereas the former changes the fitness landscape for individual life and learning. Here's the idea is that basically culture, they have added another dimension of inheritance, which is not only the genetic one, but they still understand the relationship within biological and culture within the evolutionary framework, so with the gene side. They attribute to genes something like special role in evolution. Now, I think that William and Clark and Mike are pretty much dead on. They are right to criticize modularity, they are right to criticize evolutionary psychology. I like the neuroconstructivist understanding, and I think it's fully compatible with the developmental consideration I've made before. And I like this analogy between culture and biology. However, I think there is perhaps a more powerful context in which one can understand this relationship, this bond. That is the context offered by development. So I propose to residuate ecological inheritance from an evolutionary context for the developmental one. A context in which basically there is a parity in development, where the life cycle of the organism is the unit of evolution, where the crucial notions are those of interactive construction, co-variation, co-evolution, a context where the biological takes the form of soft constraints, a context in which evolution is understood as a change in the spectrum of developmental resources. So in some, a context in which nothing can become a developmental cause without interacting with its interactive. So in agreement with proponents of DST, I think we should talk or speak with the distinction, renounce the distinction between genetic and ecological inheritance, and talk about extended inheritance, or better, exogenetic inheritance or developmental resources. Now, the exogenetic inheritance there is to do with what an organism inherits. It's basically the idea that what an organism inherits is a wide spectrum of developmental resources. And this spectrum of resources includes necessary genetic factors, but also encompasses equally necessary and reliably reproduced epigenetic, bodily, social, ecological, epistemic, and symbolic resources for development. So basically, I think that we better understand the phenomenon of deconstruction between a developmental framework and, I propose an agreement with Stotz and also with Weston King, who came up with this idea before the net, 20 years ago. The idea that we should talk about developmental deconstruction or ontogenetic deconstruction. And we can define it as the set of complex legacies inherited by offspring with necessary developmental resources. Now, here, what is the beneficial move, you might want to ask. But I think there is a beneficial move both for biology and for the cognitive sciences. Now, the beneficial move for biology is, basically ontogenetic niche construction combines the notion of scaffolding, of active scaffolding from niche construction with the idea of development and developmental consideration from the exogenetic inheritance from DST. So I think it can provide a more profitable alternative, say, to the unsatisfactory debate, the persistent unsatisfactory debate between nature and nurture. Ontogenetic niche is also important because I think makes the transmission of cultural information more reliable. Why? Because we are talking about ontogeny, so it puts the individual into a context of adaptive plasticity in which learning processes are involved in development. And so we have, yes, extended inheritances that are inherited, but we have also inheritances that are learned by a behavioral and developmental plasticity. For the cognitive science, the benefit, is basically by grounding nature in development and development of the mechanism of exogenetic inheritance, ontogenetic niche construction shows us a more dynamical account of the relationship between biological and non-biological, and then this shows us a more dynamical account of the relationship that span the brain-body boundary, right? So we have this picture where genetic and exogenetic factors interact to modify the life cycle of the organism, and this gives rise to soft constraints. Now the development. Now this is to do with the idea of the development. The developmental matrix of resources. Basically, not only the conditions for development, but also changes the dynamics of the cognitive system and alters the kind of possibility open to us as cognizers. So this maybe can entail a new understanding of the very notion of human nature. Our nature, if there is one at all, has to lie in development and is defined through development. So here, niche construction scaffolds our nature. The idea is that it is out of these multilayered processes that the capacity or interaction with the capacities of human beings emerge. So we have a context in which biology and culture are not separate, much less antagonistic. They are not only analogous, as Mike and Andy maybe think, but we have a context in which they are complementary. So in doing so, they become instrumental for organisms to achieve biological fitness in the long run. The idea is that culture makes human as much as the reverse. So here, which of these drive us to the conclusion of this talk, to the last slide, which can work both as a conclusion and as a starting point for further discussion. I'd like to see it as a slide that favors discussion for the research. So, the consideration about development I've just made, I think, at least substantially undermine any intracranialist account of cognition and offers us a strong arguments against the integrated model proposed by the Kotnitz. But also, and here it's from maybe the last thing, can provide us with the means power for me is to resurrect, to successfully resuscitate, to bring back to the fore the standard social science model. Now, the standard social science model is that, as a model, has been proposed by Gould, Levantine back in time, and has been undermined by this evolutionary psychological approach. Well, we can use the standard mind and the idea of complementarity to argue and bring back to the cognitive sciences this model. Here, the idea is not on the mind, and I have to thank the great John Sutton for giving me this nice quote from Geertz. If you think, well, this quote is taken from a book that Geertz wrote almost 50 years ago, when Andy was just 10 years old, something like this. So to me, it sounds very much like EMP, especially the last sentence. So basically, me and John, when I go down there, he told me that, well, he wants to do this, to make a defense of this, a revival of this standard social science model on the basis of EMT, and we plan to write this and to work out this into a paper, maybe something like this. And that's it. I just want to thank the people who helped me with the presentation. And it's probably the analogy. And then just take home message. We can leave this up for discussion. I think it could be nice. It's from a paper we just published in June. I don't know. That's it.